My guest, Saul Bellow, is perhaps the United States' most honored living writer, having received the Nobel, the Pulitzer, and 3 National Book Awards. New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani has described Bellow as creating characters who are caught in the middle of a spiritual crisis, overwhelmed by the sheer muchness of the world, and frightened by the stubborn fact of death. Bellow was born in Montreal in 1915, but grew up in Chicago, where he lives today and where many of his novels are set. His books include The Adventures of Augie March, Seize the Day, Herzog, Humboldt's Gift, and Henderson the Rain King. His new book is a novella called The Bellarosa Connection. The narrator of the story heads an institute for memory technique in Philadelphia. He tells the story of his late friend, a Jewish immigrant who was saved from the Holocaust in an escape operation overseen by the Broadway producer Billy Rose. I asked Saul Bellow to read the opening of The Bellarosa Connection.
As founder of the Mnemosyne Institute in Philadelphia, 40 years in the trade, I trained many executives, politicians, and members of the defense establishment. And now that I am retired, with the Institute in the capable hands of my son, I would like to forget about remembering, which is an Alice in Wonderland proposition. In your twilight years, having hung up your gloves or sheathed your knife, you don't want to keep doing what you did throughout your life. A change, your kingdom for a change. A lawyer will walk away from his clients, a doctor from his patients. A general will paint China, a diplomatist turned to fly fishing. My case is different in that I owe my worldly success to the innate gift of memory. A tricky word, innate, referring to the hidden sources of everything that really matters. As I used to say to clients, memory is life. That was a neat way to impress a member of the National Security Council whom I was coaching. But it puts me now in an uncomfortable position, because if you have worked in memory, which is life itself, there is no retirement except in death.
So Bellow, as this character tells us in the first paragraph, he wants to forget about remembering. Has this been a period where memory has been especially persistent or troubling to you?
Well, I seem to be one of these curious cases of a person whose memory is continuous. Nietzsche wrote an essay on history in which he says some rather curious things about remembering. He says a strong man can forget those things that will injure him. And I suppose that that's true, so that the power of forgetting should be paired with the power of memory, because the capacity to forget is will preserve your life in some instances. On the other hand, there is no continuity in human life without memory. It's one of the things that distinguishes us from the animals. Not all of us want to be distinguished, but if you insist on distinguishing, making such a distinction, this is one of the main points to bear in mind.
I want to quote something that you wrote in 1987. This was in an essay in the New York Times Book Review. And you wrote, as a Middle Westerner, the son of immigrant parents, I recognized at an early age that I was called upon to decide for myself to what extent my Jewish origins, my surroundings, my schooling were to be allowed to determine the course of my life. When you were young and realizing that you had these choices to make, what did you see as your options when you were thinking how much your background was going to determine what your future was going to be?
Well, I think that at a very early age, I think before puberty, I'd already decided that I wanted to be a writer, and this really, drew me apart from my family.
Your father had been a businessman.
Well, my father had been the usual rabbinical student who came to America and found nothing better to do than business, and he didn't do it too well. He was not rigidly orthodox. I was not imposed on that way. I just wanted to go my own way, and I did.
You also said that you think you might have become a rabbi if the great world, the world of the streets, had not been so seductive. What was seductive? What did you see? And what do you mean by the world of the streets? What exactly were you exposed to?
I mean Chicago in the 20s. I mean the streets, street life, pool rooms, sports, a modicum of criminal activity, which was inescapable in Chicago during the 20s, the bang bang time of Prohibition, and so on, and just the sense that you were participating in the life of this immense and expanding civilization, which was so fascinating that it drew me away from my Jewishness, not so as to make me forget it, but that I wanted to combine it with other things. I mean, I was deeply unwilling to follow anybody's blueprint from either side of the equation.
I've got to ask, you mentioned something about criminal activity. Were you involved in petty crimes yourself?
Well, every kid is involved in petty crimes, always a certain amount of theft and shoplifting and criminal intentions, which are much more powerful than the crimes you commit when you're a kid.
Were you ever caught for anything?
No, I wasn't, no.
Did
I
you?
Mean, yeah. I was never interested in shoplifting at Woolworths and things like that that people used to get caught at. But if I were working in a department store, as I once did, say at a barrel of surprise packages for Christmas, for a quarter apiece, my buddy and I, who were dressed as Santa Claus's helpers, would pocket an occasional quarter. Never got caught.
Mm-hmm.
But I never went in for big time dishonesty.
Right. So when you were growing up, did you read a lot too?
Yes, I did.
Did that let you in on other worlds outside Chicago?
Oh, immensely. That was really terrific. Of course, the first book I read was, the first books I read were the opening books of the Old Testament, which I read in Hebrew and translated into Yiddish, which made an enduring impression on me.
Pretty ambitious for starting out, huh?
Well, I think this is the way Jewish kids started out in traditional Orthodox families.
Did your mother want you to be a rabbi?
Oh, definitely. Like my grandfather, her father.
And what were your parents' reaction when they figured out that what you wanted to do was right?
Well, my father thought it was a brainstorm. My mother died when I was only 17, so she didn't live to see the worst. But my father was dismayed at all this and thought it was improvident and so on and so on. I thought he was improvident, watching him run his business.
What kind of business was it?
He was he had a coal yard and supplied apartment houses with coal.
Did that seem very boring to you, like the last life in the world you
wanted
to have?
No, it was very. It was not boring at all. It was very exciting. I often worked in the yard. Not shoveling coal, but at the scale. So I knew the life at an early age.
Saul Bellow is my guest. He has a new novella. It's called The Bella Rosa Connection. Now, you went to New York for the first time, I think, when you were 17. You went to sell your first novel. I'm thinking of how much confidence you must have had in yourself to, at the age of 17, think that you had a chance of selling it to a publisher.
Your information is a little incorrect.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
How old were you?
It wasn't I that went to New York at 17. It was my pal, Sidney Harris.
Oh, I thought you went with him.
No. I didn't go with him.
Oh.
No, I had to stay at home and face the music.
Which was what?
Which was that I had conspired with him to run away to New York. He had written a novel. We were both schoolboys, high school boys. I wrote the introduction to the novel, which was nearly as long, I think. Then we tossed a coin to see who would take it to New York to be published. This was on Division Street in Chicago in the old Polish-Jewish neighborhood. He won the toss. So without a moment's hesitation, he tucked the manuscript under his sweater and he took off. I had to answer to his mother.
What'd you tell her?
He was an only child. I wouldn't tell her anything, of course, because that would be squealing. Though I was a literary type, I was also brought up in Chicago, and I knew how bad it was to squeal. So I kept my mouth shut. And his mother, who was an English woman, Cockney lady, and my eldest brother, who was in the habit of policing me, took me down to the Missing Persons Bureau. We went downtown on the streetcar, and I was confronted by the cops in the Missing Persons Bureau. "Where is Sidney J. Harris?" I wouldn't talk. That was bad, but my brother, when he got home, broke into the only private lock drawer I ever had in boyhood, and he found letters that Sidney had been sending me, and so the game was up. But it wasn't I that went to New York at the age of 17, it was Sidney.
So what was the outcome of the book?
Well, he went to an old Chicago bookseller who had set up in New York in the early 30s as an independent publisher. His name was Pat Cavici. And Pat was very impressed with his gifts and offered him an advance to do another book, not this one, which I have to admit was not much good, neither his book nor my introduction, announcing him as a great genius, coming genius, and denouncing bourgeois America and so on. We were 16 at the time.
So what did get you to New York? And you lived in New York from, well, through part of the 40s through the 60s, is that right?
Well, that's where New York was where the action was. And if you were interested in the literary life, you couldn't stay in Chicago anymore because the great literary days of Chicago were definitely finished by the middle of the Depression years. And anybody who was somebody had already gone off. It was either in Hollywood or New York, and there was nobody left in Chicago. So I went to New York. I hitchhiked to New York a few times to start a literary career. And somehow I did.
In your book, Humboldt's Gift, you refer to, quote, the fastidious goy critics on guard for the Protestant establishment and the genteel tradition. Now, you were really one of the first of the modern Jewish novelists to really make it and reach a wide audience in America. Did you ever feel when you were starting out that you were up against a non-Jewish establishment who might keep you out?
Well, it always helps a young writer to be a belligerent. Militancy is what he chugs along on. So you have to discount. You have to enter a discount for some of this.
Uh-huh.
It's true that we had the experience of first of being locked out, and then of. Being admitted partly as under the aspect of curiosity, you know, I mean, as Samuel Johnson said about lady poets, they're like dogs that walk on their hind legs. The miracle, what is interesting is not that they do it badly, but that they can do it at all. And I think that this was the category I felt myself being thrust in, and I didn't really like it very much.
What gave you that feeling?
I was battlesome. Well, you know, we had no sooner arrived and begun publishing books, people like Malamud and I, and later on Roth, Then we were tagged as Jewish writers. Nobody wants to be tagged in that way. I mean, we thought of ourselves as belonging to the mainstream. We were Americans of Jewish origin. That didn't mean that we had to be tagged that way. And I, for one, really didn't like it. And I jokingly named Roth, Malamud, and myself as the Hart Schaffner and Marx of American literature. But that stuck rather. I mean, the idea that you were not a full partner in this enterprise.
Did you ever feel that, looking back, do you ever feel that there were things that you kept out of your voice as a writer, so because you didn't want to be pegged as a Jewish writer? Before you really came...
Oh, no. I simply wrote what turned me mm-hmm. on, and mm-hmm. I never gave this much thought at all.
Mm-hmm. You changed your name when you started writing from Solomon Bellows to Saul Bellow, and I was wondering why you changed your name and why you chose the change that you did.
Well, I had been known under both names in the family from the beginning, and you know, I had a choice open to me, and I simply decided that that Saul would be better than Solomon because of the little verse Solomon Grundy, born on Monday, etc., etc. And it was just, besides, I wanted to break with everybody, my own family too. So I chose the other name, which was a legitimate name and belonged to me.
What was your family's reaction when you changed the name?
They couldn't have cared less.
Why not? Because it did represent, I'm sure, to them somewhat of a break from the family.
I didn't deny anything, didn't deny they were my family, didn't turn my back on them, didn't assume some fancy name like Courtney or Smithson or anything like that. There I was. I wasn't trying to hide anything.
Chicago is the setting of much of your fiction, but you lived in New York from the 40s through the 60s. And you say that you returned to Chicago when writers became more political in New York. And I was wondering what kind of political expression you wanted to get away from when you left New York.
Oh, well, I just didn't care much for the carrying on about the Vietnam War and so on. I mean, I took my own stand on these matters. I didn't care to be associated with a whole gang of other people.
And did it accomplish what you wanted to move to Chicago in terms of getting away from a group?
Well, I had belonged to a group in New York. I belonged to the old Partisan Review group.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't impose anything on you, and they didn't try to school you in any attitude. They didn't prescribe for you politically. You could think anything you liked. The new outfit wanted to prescribe for you.
Who were you thinking of in the new outfit?
Oh, the mailers and the people like that, people around him. Oh, well, there were several literary establishments that sprang up about that time. There was a New York Review of Books literary establishment. There was the Mailerite establishment. There was the Columbia University establishment. Headed by Lionel Trilling and Jacques Barzin, I suppose. I just didn't want to belong to any of these outfits. I had nothing in common with them particularly.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm curious, you've never written a memoir. So many writers do write a memoir about their lives. And I wonder why you haven't.
I wonder, too. But I'm fascinated by the memoirs of other people, but I'm not sure that my own memoirs would be as interesting as, say, the memoirs of Casanova or somebody like that. I did my best, but I don't think I can keep up.
Well, Casanova aside, there is quite a tradition of the literary memoir.
Yes, and some of them are dreadfully dull or self-justifying. And I'm just too busy to do it.
Mm-hmm. In 1970,
when I say I'm busy, I always like to qualify that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not just busy in the way a Wall Street broker is busy. I'm busy trying to find out what the next necessary thing to write is, because life is short. You don't want to write anything unnecessary. I don't want to have to devote years of my life to doing something that doesn't interest me most deeply. So I always think of the next necessary thing to do as a writer. And it hasn't occurred to me as yet that my autobiography might be necessary. At the moment, it still looks superfluous.
In 1975, in a piece in Newsweek, you expressed your fear of being elevated to grand old man status. And you said that that's a way of just being eased out. I was wondering if you still are concerned about that, and if you feel you've tried to.
I'm not concerned about it at all. I just don't do it.
Don't do what? What would be required of you?
In my time, I've watched writers and poets playing this role, and I just don't care for it.
What's the role specifically that you're talking about?
Oh, the sort of Robert Frost grand old man role. You know. I am now the spokesman of my generation, or I am the spokesman for America, and so I've never considered myself that kind of spokesman.
So are there things that you turn down because you don't want to play that role? Certain speaking invitations or certain things that you are asked to write? Certain stands you are expected to take?
Well, I turn down invitations because I don't want to waste my time. That is to say, if I didn't have anything better to do, I might accept them and go forth and glitter as a public figure. But since I'm too busy, I turn them aside for the most part.
Your last two books have been novellas. Do you think you're going to continue in that vein for a while? Do you have a third one that's going to be published?
No, I don't. Well, I write what my inner voice tells me to write. And it's in charge, not me.
Uh-huh.
I know I should say not I. But I say not me because it's more colloquial.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.